I'm Rhys Pedler, and I'm the project coordinator for the Wild Deserts Project here in Sturt National Park in the very far northwest corner of New South Wales. We're just about 20 kilometres from where the three states, New South Wales, SA and Queensland, meet.
What is the Wild Deserts Project?
Well, Wild Deserts is a partnership between New South Wales National Parks and Wildlife, the University of New South Wales and Ecological Horizons. So it's a 10-year funded project with the aim of trying to restore the local desert ecosystem, and a big part of that is the reintroduction of some locally extinct mammals. Australia's had one of the worst mammal extinction record on the planet. We've lost a couple dozen native species, native mammals that are sort of a little bit bigger than a mouse and smaller than a wallaby. And there's quite a range of species that have been lost from this area. And so our project over 10 years hopes to return some of them. And a lot of the work is around excluding feral species. So we have a 50 kilometre fence network with these feral free exclosures. So we exclude all rabbits and cats and foxes from those areas. And then we've started undertaking some reintroduction. So the crest-tailed mulgara, the bilby, and more recently some bandicoots, and another bandicoot species going in this year, we hope. A big part of our work is research. You know, we the University of New South Wales is one of the major partners, and so we are trying to understand the changes that occur when we remove the feral species and return some of these extinct species, and compare between our, you know, scientific treatments, which are on a grand scale. We're talking thousands of hectares. We have a scientific sample over those sort of scales, and look at what happens to the ecosystem, to the vegetation, to the birds, to the insects and invertebrates, and all those things. We're really trying to understand the system and try and adapt our management to return this desert to something more like it was when Europeans first arrived in this area.
And what kind of management does that look like? There's the reintroduction of native species. Yep. Is there any other sort of things you're doing?
Excluding the ferals is a big part of that, and that includes both predators, cats and foxes, but also grazers. So rabbits, of course, have had an unbelievable toll in this area, and the changes that they made to the desert ecosystem were a huge blow to native species. And then things like cats and foxes followed hot on the heels of the rabbits. Also, things have got out of balance in this area too. So I guess we're inside a national park, so there's been no grazing of sheep and cattle here for the last 40 years or so. It was formerly, we're at Fort Grey now, which is formerly a sheep station. But there's also been really high numbers of kangaroos in this part of the world. We're inside the dog fence. We have less predation by dingoes or wild dogs, and so kangaroo numbers are in really high abundance, and so they're one of the primary grazers here in this system. So we've actually excluded kangaroos from some parts of our project area, and then we have them in sort of lower, more sustainable numbers in other big parts. And so looking at the effects of changing the grazing regime is a big part of our project too.
Hmm. Now you've built exclosures.
That's right.
They're different to enclosures.
Yeah, exactly.
Can you explain that difference is?
A great point. Yeah, so we are trying to exclude with our exclosures. We're trying to exclude cats and foxes and rabbits, and then allow our native species to prosper inside. And we're not trying to keep the native species that we reintroduce or animals generally inside those exclosures. We want them to get out, and we want them. Some of the animals, like the crest-tailed mulgara, are small enough to go through the wire netting that we've used. We're really hoping, and there's you know, evidence from other places where this has been done in other parts of Australia, that the positive effects from our exclusion of cats and rabbits and foxes will spill out over the landscape. So things like native hopping mice, we have dusky hopping mice here. They were listed as extinct in New South Wales at one point, and then they have a really high conservation rating. Inside our exclosures, they're starting to boom because the rabbits aren't eating their food anymore. There's no cats and foxes there to eat them. We have native predators like snakes and owls and things like that eating them, but they're starting to grow in number, and we're expecting that them to sort of spill out through the fences and to, you know, extend those benefits beyond. And the other thing to say there too is that we are trying with this project to find ways to get some of the reintroduced mammals back beyond fences. We're hoping to not have to use these netting fences in decades to come. And so we have this large area of about 10,000 hectares where we have low densities of feral cats, and we're hoping to breed bilbies and bandicoots and things inside our exclosures and allow them out into that wild training zone. It's sort of a halfway house, if you will, between the predator, well, the feral predator free area inside our exclosures and the big bad outside world. And my wife, Rebecca West, who's also the principal ecologist for the project, and others have done a lot of work on this at another site in South Australia, where they essentially trained bilbies and bettongs to be smarter about cats. And over quite a short period of a couple years, you could see these really distinct behavioural changes of the individuals that were released and also their offspring.
Wow.
Starting to behave differently towards people, but also coexisting with low managed densities of feral cats.
Mm. And so learning to hide.
That's right, really? Yeah, or learning, yep. Yeah. So for instance, these burrowing bettongs that are like a small wallaby that lives in a burrow, a control group kept in the feral-free part of the Arid Recovery Reserve in northern South Australia, they were so naive to predators and to humans. They could come up and they'd sniff your shoes, and you could be driving along in the Toyota with the spotlight, and they would sit in the middle of the road and look at you from a meter in front of the car. Whereas the control, so they were the control group, and then the ones exposed to cats in this large area, they very quickly became so on edge that you couldn't get close to them on foot, radio tracking them with a torch. You just wouldn't see them. And you wouldn't see them from a vehicle except as they disappeared. So really distinct changes in their behaviour over a short period. And then their survival compared to predator-naive animals was greater. And so it's only a short amount of time, but it's proof of concept perhaps, and we're hoping to build on that here at Wild Deserts and ultimately to find ways to get these animals beyond fences. We can't keep on building endless, long, expensive fences that have to be maintained in perpetuity. It'd be much better to find some strategies to get our animals beyond fences in landscapes where we control the numbers of cats and foxes to a level that can allow these animals to coexist.
Hmm. I did get the opportunity to come out here a couple of years ago while you were trapping. Yeah. And we were talking about that before. It was a really dry year, 2018. And I remember there was a struggle to even trap anything.
Yeah, that's right.
But there's been so much rain the last year. How is it looking out here? And you've been trapping again. Have you noticed a difference?
Yeah, we're about to do our annual trapping again next week. But over the last few years, so the depths of that drought were pretty depressing in 2018, 2019. And then we had some fantastic rain in early 2020, and then rain right throughout 2020, follow up last year in 2021. And then this summer again, we've had a fantastic rainfall season. So yeah, what was bare red sand hills with dying trees, you know, these age old mulgas that would have been, hundreds of years old, were dying in the drought, sort of, you know, signifying that was the worst drought that they'd experienced in that time. So no, and you know, long time locals, we've been here for 5 years now, but people who've been here for 60 or 70 years telling us that this is the worst they'd ever seen it. To the turnaround where it's yeah, up there with some of the best that they've seen, where there's grass and budgies, and we've got a lake here, Lake Pinneroo, just across from our field station here, that filled last year, and we can go for a swim over in the lake or take our kids for a paddle, and yeah, just incredible to see that change, and really, really exciting place to be when that sort of thing's happening.
And are you seeing any response yet in the species you've introduced, or in local wildlife?
Absolutely, yeah. We were able to release the first of the species in 2020 after that drought-breaking rain, and we really held on to try to wait for some rain before we reintroduced them. So we've had great survival and breeding of all three species that we've released so far. Excuse me.
You're right. Have a drink.
So yeah, the first species, crest-tailed mulgara, we released 19 individuals, and now we're looking at a population of a couple hundred individuals already. Bilbies were released in 2020, and again another group in 2021, and yeah, they've all been that we had 100% survival of the individuals that we released, all 40. Were still alive at 3 months post release, and most of them were able to find them alive 6 months post release. So that's really exciting. And of course, they've been breeding. Every time we catch them, we find that they've the females have pouch young and things. And similar story with Shark Bay or Western Barred Bandicoots that we released in 2021. So we've been lucky in some ways, and we've also tried to plan things in a way to try and take advantage of those good seasons. But yeah, if we could have ordered the weather, having dry times when we were trying to eradicate the feral species, and then good rainfall around when we were trying to release some of these reintroduced species, it couldn't have been better. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
You mentioned you and Beck have been here for 5 years.
Yeah.
Where did you come from before that, and why out here? What was your interest?
Well, we were living in South Australia at a little mining town called Roxby Downs. And Beck, my wife, is originally from the UK, so she's come a long way to be here, and it's a much more remote place than she grew up, and of course, more remote than where I grew up as well. But I guess both of us love the desert ecosystem and the variability, I guess. And I mean, I was talking about these disastrous droughts to flooding rains, and I guess that change in the system is what is so exciting, seeing that variability and seeing how the desert ecosystem transforms. You know, within hours of a rain, there's frogs emerging from the soil that have been buried for years, and within days you can see green grass starting to shoot up through the soil, and little shield shrimp and little crustaceans that get to the size of a 50-cent piece hatching out of eggs in puddles, and the place is just transformed. And that's one of the things I really love about the desert and this place. But I guess for us, we were really interested in trying to do something tangible for the environment, being involved in this research that we find really interesting and exciting. And I guess in a career as an environmental scientist or ecologist, you can often find yourself sitting in the office doing lots of paperwork or managing other people, and not getting out there hands-on and doing the things that you set out to do when you start your career. So this job is a really exciting one for us. We're working with a fantastic team of scientists from Uni of New South Wales and Ecological Horizons, and people who've done, involved in the cutting edge of some of this reintroduction science and predator research and control technology. And we feel like it's a way to, really drive some of this research and management and see some great rewards, as well as trying to restore this patch of the earth, as well as and find techniques and things that can be applied more broadly, so it's not just this area, that it can be, the lessons learnt here can be applied elsewhere, we hope.
Part of being out here and I guess improving this land is attracting resources through tourism. How's that kind of shaping up? What does that look like in this area?
Well, yeah, we've We've been really lucky. So as part of our work with National Parks, we've developed a new visitor area up on the Dune Scenic Drive, which is the main road to Cameron Corner from Tibooburra, and a thoroughfare for 20 or 30,000 vehicles a year. With some funding from the Sturt Steps Tourism Infrastructure Project, we have been really lucky to commission some giant wire netting sculptures, and they were actually the offcuts from our ferrule proof fence. So we had around 2,000 rolls of netting that we used to create our exclosures. Each one of them had about a metre or two at the end that was too tightly coiled to be useful, and we commissioned these sculptures of some of the extinct mammals. And of course the link there is that the tourism infrastructure grant is called Sturt Steps, retracing the steps of the explorer Charles Sturt. And of course we here at Fort Grey, right at, so it was named by Charles Sturt, one of his exploration depots when he came through this area. And in his diaries, he wrote about some of the things he saw, and it's incredible to see the changes that have occurred since his visit. So, I mean, he talked about local Aboriginal people living on the lake and the signs of their occupation and his interactions with local Aboriginal people, and the animals that he saw them eating, like hopping mice and bandicoots, and how his interpretation, at least, of how they used the landscape. And you know, those species, some of those species are gone from this area, and we're bringing them back, or some of them are gone forever, of course. Also some of the changes in the landscape generally with his observations of dingoes and kangaroos and ground cover and things like that, so really fascinating. But I guess the link to Sturt is really interesting in that story, and we're bringing back some of the species that he recorded that were since lost, and the netting that we used in the sculpture is one of the main tools that we've been using to bring them back. So yeah, it's been exciting. But more generally on the tourist stuff, so this visitor area, we've just installed a whole heap of signage with information about the local ecology and the work that's going on, and some of those historical aspects as well. There's some other tourist infrastructure that we hope to install in the Fort Grey campground in the next year or two. So yeah, it's an exciting time for that as well, yeah.
It's a pretty challenging time in terms of climate change. It can feel easy to feel like projects like this are...
That's right.
...hopeless.
Yeah,
or, you know.
I understand,
but
yeah.
But what gives you hope in working on this? What makes you hopeful about the impact of these kind of projects?
Yeah, like you say, it's hard to find things that you can tangibly do to sort of help in terms of the situation that we face at the moment with the plight of the world and climate change and all that sort of stuff. I guess for us personally, we see this as a way that we can contribute, which is great. Looking at some of the climate change predictions and the predictions of hotter, more severe droughts and longer droughts and more frequent and more severe flooding, and you know the variation in the system and the extremes are going to be accentuated. Yeah, it makes us all worry, I guess. I guess trying to restore some sort of resilience in our ecosystems is really important, and that's why a project like this is so important. Trying to find ways to not only preserve these threatened species that are, you know, hanging on pretty precariously, really, you know, also trying to find ways to manage feral predators and herbivores so that the ecosystem has a chance. That's really important and can be not only applied here but in other parts of the arid zone as well. So I guess there's some real challenges for us all and for our this project specifically with climate change, but some important outcomes and also lessons that we can get out of this that will help, we hope. Yeah.
So yeah, it's less about just, like you said, preserving dying species. It's about like actually creating places where those species can come back and maybe have a positive impact on...
That's right.
...and to be resilient.
That's right. So some of these species that we're returning have really important part in the ecosystem. They're known as, so for instance, bilbies are known as ecosystem engineers. They're burrowing, so they do lots of digging for their food. They dig up seeds and tubers and invertebrates and things like that. And these little foraging pits that they create help to infiltrate water into the soil. They trap trap seeds and things like that. So a landscape with bilbies in it is potentially a much more functioning landscape. The water infiltration is different. The seed germination is different. If we can find a way to get bilbies back into the broader landscape here outside the national park on those pastoral properties where we have sheep and cattle grazing next door, potentially they will be making that a more resilient landscape.
So you're kind of breeding little teams of bilby conservationists.
That's right, yeah, absolutely.
Sending them out.
That's what we hope, yeah, we hope we can do.
Cool. Is there anything you'd say to tourists who are heading up this way and wanting to have a look about, I guess, what to look out for and also maybe kind of how to be respectful as well?
Yeah, so I guess one of the important things is being prepared for the remote area, and yeah, often we find ourselves helping out people who aren't properly prepared, and it can be pretty unsafe. It could be fatal, I guess, if you're not properly prepared in terms of your vehicle and your carrying adequate water and communications and things like that. In terms of travelling through the national park, our exclosures and the area that we manage is mainly off limits to public access. This new visitor area, we give people the chance to come in and walk through a little pedestrian gate into our wild training zone and see some of the work that's being undertaken. In the future, we hope to potentially offer some sort of tag along tours and things like that. We're not quite there yet. In terms of visitor impact, tread lightly and all those things that you hear about taking only photographs and leaving only footsteps. Thinking about your impact and how long things take to change in the desert. Trees take such a long time to grow. There's a great illustration over in the Fort Grey campground there of a mulga tree, looking at the rings of growth in the cross section of the tree, and the mulga tree that you dead bit of mulga that you throw on the campfire was a seedling probably when the first explorers were in this area, and some of them much older than that. So it takes such a long time for firewood to grow on mulgas and coolabah trees and things like that, and we have to think about those things when we're wanting to sit around a great big campfire out in the desert on a chilly night. I think that's worth remembering. Yeah,
definitely. Yeah, you mentioned you and Becca are out here with a young family.
Yeah,
what have you experienced as challenges of raising a family out here?
Oh, with raising a family, yeah, the remoteness and the isolation, especially for kids. We've got a little 3.5-year-old daughter, and she just craves spending time with other kids, and I guess during COVID that's been even more challenging. The remoteness is a challenge for every part of our daily lives, with getting equipment and supplies for the project, but also for our family and in terms of socialising and seeing family and all that sort of stuff. So we're about 450 k's from Broken Hill. And our nearest, that's our nearest supermarket or major medical centre or shops or anything like that. Our nearest medical helps in Tibooburra, 110 k's away. We have the Flying Doctor that are available for medical consultations over the phone, which is amazing. So certainly had nothing major medical-wise, but just, with young kids and being first-time parents, sometimes we've had a bit of anxiety about different things, and it's been really great to have the Flying Doctor at the end of the line. But also, there's some challenges with those things too, being prepared and having supplies and all that sort of stuff. Yeah.
Mm. Yep. And what makes it fun for a family?
Well, I mean, there's so many things that kids and families can do here that you just don't get to do elsewhere. So our little daughter we've got a little 9-month-old baby as well, but they're, you know, out in the red sand every day and out experiencing nature. And you know, I mentioned Lake Pinaroo that's filled, and they're over there swimming in this incredible outback lake that's full once every 10 or 20 years perhaps. Also hanging out with some of the station kids on surrounding properties. We've got some great friends next door at Wacker, and they have kids that are a bit older, but you know, our little daughter's out with them, you know, riding their pet sheep and just being out in the bush. There's some great services we have, like the toy library. So there's a monthly toy library on a rotation between a whole number of properties on the tri-state border region in SA and Queensland and New South Wales, and that's been fantastic for our kids to be able to catch up with other kids and the parents as well. So yeah, there's lots of experiences and things happening here that you just don't get the opportunity to do living in a city or even a big rural centre. So there's pros and cons, I guess. Yeah,
definitely. You cover a huge area, as you said, and getting to know this place and spend a lot of time on the land. But is there somewhere, and don't give away your secret spots, you don't want tourists going to, is there somewhere that you'd recommend on this trail or in this patch that you're just like, you've got to go see this spot, make sure you don't miss it?
Lake Pinaroo here at Fort Grey is an incredible place, I think, whether it's filled with water or dry, and just seeing the history there, and you can see the changes in terms of the dead trees in the middle from the 1974 floods, and just even when it's dry, walking around in the bed of that huge lake, it's about 7 or 8 kilometres long and 3 or 4 k's wide, just seeing the volume of water that it must take to fill that, but also when it's full at the moment, and there's budgies and cockatiels nesting in the tree hollows, and barn owls roosting there and going out to forage at night, catching small mammals and things like that. It is a pretty magical spot. I mean, the variability of the desert and the changes in the desert mean that a place that's very lifeless and boring at one time when you might visit might be absolutely teeming with life the next time. So even just standing on a red sandhill with mulga trees and hop bush and things like that, it can be, you know, in a dry time, like when you were here last, there's not much happening there. But then just seeing it come to life, so standing up there today or at sunrise, you know, you would hear all these birds calling in the morning. At the moment we've got little flocks of budgies and cockatiels flying around and chats, and there's a lot of places that are special places to be if you get the timing right.
Beautiful. I think that's all the questions I've got.
All right.
Are you happy with that? Is there anything else you want to add we didn't cover?
I think that's pretty good.